This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, you'll get a fresh update on Japan after the tsunami and nuclear accident. Is it a chance to build new green cities, or a vision of what we all face as the oil runs out? Then a quick interview with anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott at the Occupy the EPA protest in Washington, followed by an invitation by Susan Moser to get real about our difficult future as we destabilize the climate. There's no time to waste. Do you worry about an energy shortage, a nuclear accident, or a severe economic hit? Welcome to Japan, which is dealing with all three following the deadly tsunami and nuclear accident in March 2011. We have a new report from Warren Karlenzig, who just toured Japan with the United Nations Group. As the founder of Common Current, Warren advises city and national governments on sustainability. He's a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. In 2009, Radio EcoShock broadcast Warren's speech at a Vancouver panel. Warren, why did you go to Japan?
Well, I was invited by the United Nations Center for Regional Development, which I have worked with in the past, to train mayors from around Asia on sustainable urban planning. And they were in conversations with the Japan Ministry of Foreign Affairs to bring in outside experts to advise the nation on potential redevelopment strategies for the areas impacted by the tsunami and the Fukushima nuclear accident.
Well, we can't get to the impact of that nuclear accident or Japan's exciting prospects for green energy without first giving respect to the people who live with the tragic loss of more than 20,000 lives, of whole towns and a large part of the country. What's your feeling of how people in Japan are coping with that unimaginable stress?
Well, one thing they're trying to do is just to be engaged, with rebuild their own personal lives, to try to get a temporary shelter. There are now over 300,000 people in Japan living in temporary shelters, and they're also trying to figure out how to bring back their economy or to salvage what they had left of their old economy, and just to keep their spirits up and to keep fighting, because the survivors feel that, you know, they're lucky to have survived such a disaster, and so that, you know, they kind of need to take that and move it forward into the future. So that's really kind of the attitude we met with there. And it was a lot more uplifting than I expected.
And thinking about how we survive large-scale disasters, how much help would you say comes from the government and how much from self-organization by the citizens?
Well, in Japan, it seems that you know, a certain amount comes from the national government, the prefecture-level governments, which are equivalent to our states in the United States or territories in Canada. And the international community was very quick to respond with a lot of aid. You know, we heard some fascinating stories how the U.S. military, for instance, in their boats offshore of Japan, came into some of these towns and were some of the first responders to dig people out or try to rescue people. Also, international organizations, a whole range of, there are 450 non-governmental organizations involved in the tsunami-impacted region alone that are lending assistance, mostly on a community-by-community basis. So it's largely unorchestrated at a high level, and they're just going in and doing what they can to clean up the muck, the debris, to get people, you know, back on their feet again.
And one of the hot-button issues in Japan is the national government's plan to redistribute tsunami wreckage, including some material contaminated with radioactive waste, all over the country. What did you hear about that?
Well, we heard bits and pieces, and we witnessed some of the radioactive material. For instance, some of the soil or other debris that was deemed to be radioactive was stored in large bags or sacks or fabric. And some of these were right next to high schools or schools or right in the center of some of these disaster-impacted communities. Other things we witnessed was soil, that they're taking up the soil in some of the agricultural areas, which are spread throughout the region, and moving it in large piles. And some of the farmer we met with that was doing that on their small organic farm, they were under the impression that the national government would take away that soil once they had done that. but that is not the case so far. So there's a lot of confusion as to how to determine how radioactive the soil is besides using your own instrumentation. The other debris, you know, some of it in piles that are 100 meters high or, you know, almost 100 meters high of just the most intense mixture of materials and former houses and wood and soil and chemicals. So it's quite a mess. And really, I didn't see any sort of clear pathway to resolution.
And with almost all the nuclear reactors out of service, how are the Japanese substituting or dealing with their lack of energy?
Right, yeah, they shut down today, the second to the last one out of 54, and the last one is scheduled to go down next month. Well, there's no clear solution there, except people are conserving more than they ever have, and it's a national concerted effort and community-based effort to not use lights during the day, use passive daylighting. You know, so you walk in a building, a government building or other buildings, and they're very dim. You know, this was during the winter we were there, and they don't use indoor lights except a few emergency lights. They don't use heat in a lot of the buildings now in the disaster area. So, you know, people wear jackets and hats and scarves. It's, you know, anywhere from you know, 5 below Celsius to about 0 Celsius or maybe 1 or 2 degrees. You know, it's quite cold in these buildings, and people are making do by bundling up, and then in the rooms where they have meetings and get together and convene, they'll have a kerosene heater or two to heat things up a little more to make it tolerable. And then finally, we saw a lot of people drying their clothes in their windows, in the south-facing windows, and I think that's, you know, a traditional practice in parts of Japan, but we saw it even in Tokyo, in the northern suburbs, on a large scale, going past, you know, relatively prosperous apartment buildings and people with all their clothes out on the balcony or in the windows. And this summer is going to be the real test, because last summer they were about 25% below their production level of their baseline energy, and now they're going to be about 33% below as all the nuclear reactors go offline. So this summer will really tell how they're doing. They also have an online method. People can go on to the internet and log in and see what demand is going to be like for the day and where the peak hours are going to be. And they've been very good about not using appliances, heat, light, fans, et cetera, air conditioners during those hours when possible.
Well, this sounds like something we could all do. Do you think this sudden failure of energy supplies is comparable to a peak oil shock?
Oh, yes. It's definitely a view into, you know, our collective future globally, what some of our nations or regions or cities will be facing. And, you know, it's just a question of how it will come and what the combination of the shocks will be. Will it come to transportation? Will it come to stationary power sources? Will it come to food or our supply chains? And, you know, the answer is probably all of the above, but we can't tell what the combinations will be when the problems will first arise. So this is really a textbook example of an industrialized country that's facing something similar to peak oil, to what we will be living through in our future. We don't know when it's going to be exactly, but in terms of our civilization and how it adapts.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Warren Karlenzig. You can follow Warren at commoncurrent.com. Warren, is there an opportunity in Japan to rebuild new green cities and towns?
Yes, absolutely. And that, Alex, was one of the reasons why I was there. And I've worked around the world on sustainable urban planning and a green economic development, and I think the Japanese just wanted an outside view of what some possibilities are. The Japanese are fairly advanced in terms of their green technologies. The question is, you know, how can they apply it at such a large scale in planning communities, in planning infrastructure, in planning technologies, behaviors, citizen actions, government actions. And that the jury is still out, whether they're able to execute the way they will need to in the face of this tragedy. So I think they're just looking for all hands on deck in terms of expertise from the outside. There were a couple other, one other American with me, and other folks from Thailand, from Bangladesh, from Australia, that were also along on the tour to advise on waste management and how, for instance, some of the waste from the tsunami can be turned into potential energy sources for biomass or biofuels and things of that nature.
And in your blog, you wrote the two cities have proposed smart growth models, and one is even seeking a sort of zero emissions process. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there are a couple cities in the tsunami-damaged region, and there are different plans being bandied about for either eco-towns or future cities, they're calling them. One is Rakuza Tanaka, which is one city that was really badly damaged by the tsunami, almost virtually wiped out. They are looking at having distributed energy power their city almost exclusively. The question is, you know, how they will do that, what the plan will be, what forms of energy they will use, what the mix will be of, for instance, solar or biomass or hydro, small-scale hydro, et cetera. And a number of cities besides that city or town are also looking at smart growth, you know, building much denser, building town centers where they were a little more sprawled out before, because those will be more defensible against tsunamis also if they build on higher ground away from the flood-prone areas and they have more focused development. It's easier to manage in terms of a disaster, in terms of preparation, in terms of building and planning, and it's more efficient with infrastructure too. So there was Ofunato City is planning on more of a smart growth, but also possibly a distributed energy development scenario.
And you write that some of the barriers to smart growth are social. Tell us about the age problem and the role of women in revisioning the New Japan.
Well, traditionally, Japan has been a patriarchal society. Some of the meetings we went to in some of the towns, and we met with about five disaster-impacted towns in the tsunami region, two in the nuclear radiation-impacted region, more heavily impacted. And, one of the towns had 15 men we were meeting with, officials, and there were no women represented or, really no one representing elderly or the very young or, any of the other groups of people that have a right to and have a need to express how their new city or their new town should be designed. That was illuminating. I think that, there's just a need for them to include far more groups of people in their planning instead of just having it taken care of by a few city officials. It seems to be the Japanese way more to have society all supposedly band together in a common interest and with a common goal. But in this case, I don't know if they're really banding together across all diverse areas of their society effectively. We'll need to do that to come back. Otherwise, people will not feel that their villages or their towns or their cities are being designed or planned or at least capturing input from everyone.
And the Japanese society is already aging, and yet some of the young people are just plain leaving this area and going somewhere else. Is that the story?
That is the story, and that has been the story in Japan for a number of years. A lot of the towns to the north are thought to be fairly traditional and old-fashioned even by the young people, and there aren't many new jobs. They relied a lot on fisheries and on agriculture, small-scale agriculture, which are some of that's very popular now in North America, for instance, the small-scale ag with young people, but in Japan, not so much. And so they're going to the city, to Tokyo or other cities, Osaka, for different careers, professional careers, and they're leaving the towns behind to the older people. Now, the tsunami just made that worse. It came in and then it ravaged everything, and people thought, wow, it was already a dying city. So, there's talk of some of the towns or cities there being ghost towns or ghost cities. They're really at a crossroads as to how they will deal with their changing demographics, as something like 40% of their population will be over 65 in the future, I think a decade or two decades or three decades from now. So it's getting even worse than it is now in terms of being just an elderly society.
And the other thing that puzzled me is 1 year after, why has reconstruction not already begun?
Well, one major impediment to that is the subsidence of the ground. The ground is still sinking in many of these areas impacted by the earthquake. This was the fourth most powerful earthquake in history of our modern civilization of Earth. And it was a fault where one plate, which Japan is on, went underneath the plate that's out in the ocean. And therefore, it sunk during the event, during the earthquake of March 11, 2011. But also, it continues to sink. So there are areas where it's sinking 1, 2, 3, 4 feet since the earthquake, and it has not ceased. So they can't even begin to do reconstruction planning on some of those impacted areas until that stops and at least stabilizes and you know, gets maybe sinking an inch or, you know, a millimeter, a couple millimeters a year rather than a foot or two.
That is just amazing. The ground sinking so far, it's hard for us to imagine. Warren Karlenzig, you have talked about rumors, I would call them at this point, of a switch to renewables in Japan. Is there a difference in the views of local citizens, of local governments, and the national government? Did you get any feel for how that works?
Well, we had very few conversations at the national level. We did meet the Minister of Foreign Affairs, which is the equivalent of Secretary of State, for instance, in the United States. And we didn't have an extended conversation with him, but we did talk more with some of the local leaders from the cities and also a governor, the Fukushima prefecture. And the governors, especially the Fukushima prefecture, are opposed to nuclear power in the future. And that decision has really stood above all else in making nuclear a thing of the past in Japan, it seems. They are not going to be able to restart a number of those reactors, even if they are deemed to be safe, until they get the go-ahead from local officials. And the local officials have just seen their economies ravaged in many ways. You know, all the agricultural produce is suspect or contaminated. You know, the industries are shut down. They don't know what to do about their supply chains. You know, people can't live there. It's quite a mess, a wicked problem, a lot of people would call it. They're tangled up problems that there's no clear way to untangle them even. You know, that's some of the sentiment we heard.
And Warren, with your expertise in sustainable city design, you went to Japan as part of a multinational UN team. What do you see as the real next steps in the Japanese recovery?
Well, I outlined recommendations to the United Nations Center for Regional Development and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And the main recommendations were, number one, is to get the community involved as much as possible right now in reconstruction planning. And don't make it just something that, you know, the officials only are involved in. You know, get everyone involved. Get centers where people can go and see what kind of progress is being made and look at photos and look at drawings and look at models and just discuss these things and argue them if possible, because that makes for a much healthier plan, is to have a lot of input in and a lot of thought and sometimes a lot of friction even. So that was number one. The other recommendations were around the green economy, really just to have a more transparent process as to what they're considering. I mean, we heard, I don't know if they're rumors or what, but some of it was, you know, officials saying they want to have renewable energy and they're planning on it, but I did not have access to some of those plans. I saw some of the land use plans in Japanese, but they didn't have, even when I got translations, they didn't have much about the renewable energy, just maybe a paragraph or two here or there. They need to do real planning in terms of like a roadmap, a phased strategy, exactly how much renewable energy they're going to use in their economy and how they're going to phase it in, what they're going to phase out, and what it's going to look like in terms of infrastructure, in terms of what types of renewable energy, what types of buildings. Super efficient green buildings would be the call, obviously, but no one was even talking about green buildings, really, in our discussions with the local leaders. And, of course, it's early stage now. This is a 5 to 10 year rebuilding process. But they really need to have these conversations and a lot of the scientific analysis and economic analysis going right now, looking at, you know, for instance, how the green economy does better than the conventional economy. Studies like in California showing that, you know, it's like twice the amount of growth over 10 years or so. and what that would mean in Japan. I mean, they have the perfect opportunity. They have really a devastated area that needs to be rebuilt completely, and that is where you can gain the most efficiency out of systems that use water efficiently, use energy efficiently, use renewables, develop local food production or local supply chains when possible, and bring jobs to the region based on all these new industries, because that's really the 21st century story of growth.
Are there personal experiences that struck you on this trip?
Well, one thing was the food situation. You know, when we started our trip in the far north of the tsunami-damaged region, Iwate Province, and you know, I was a little wary of some of the food being contaminated or potentially contaminated, and wanted to reduce my exposure. And we didn't hear about it at first in the first village or two, and then suddenly we heard that the mushrooms were contaminated in the town we were in. Well, actually, the official said there was rumors of contamination at first, and when we pressed them, they said there was contamination, and it was twice the level that the national government had set. Now, mushrooms are just a staple food in Japan, and they're produced locally almost everywhere you go in many types, and it's a type of food I love. So, I was torn between wanting to support them in the region and wanting to maintain my health. And then as we traveled further south into the closer to the Fukushima plant, there was more contamination, and the soil was heavily contaminated in some areas, and they were having to remove it, or they weren't, they were left to their own devices. And so, we had one lunch of all organic local food served by in someone's home. And typically this would be, one of the highlights of my travels of somewhere to Japan or wherever. And in this case, there was anxiety, I think, on my part, because I didn't want to eat some of the food, especially the rice that is, some of that, I believe, got on the market that could be contaminated, the mushrooms, the seafood, that comes from the local area, the greens in particular, leafy greens are thought to really capture a lot of the radioactive fallout. So it really changed my experience. And, if you can't eat healthy food or potentially drink healthy water, everything else really comes into question as to how healthy and what the prospects for society are.
And as we finish up, is there anything you'd like to add for our listeners?
I'm hopeful about Japan, and I do want to return there. And I do think that people around the world should support Japan in whatever way they can, and that includes visiting Japan. Now, I've visited also further south in Japan last year, and I really thought the danger of radiation is very low in anywhere south of Tokyo, especially if you get down to Osaka or Kyoto, really very little danger. In Tokyo now, I think the danger is very reduced. The one danger is some of the food is being circulated around the country that could have some radiation in it and might have health impacts eventually for some people. That people can judge on their own. But I think we need to support Japan and even tour the tsunami-damaged region if possible, just to show people that the international community cares and that we want to support them, just as we would need this kind of support if this happened in our own backyard. It would be very important to get other people to come and to speak with them and to share the experience and to work on potential solutions. That's what we all need to do together.
You have been listening to Sustainable Cities expert Warren Karlenzig. Keep track of Warren at commoncurrent.com. Warren, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We go now to Jerry Williams, our Washington correspondent.
I'm here with physician and anti-nuclear champion Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is in Washington on March 30th for the Occupy EPA action at the EPA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Dr. Caldicott, why are we still talking about nuclear power and nuclear weapons? It's been decades. We've had a movement to do away with weapons. Now it seems as if acceptance of nuclear power is creeping back into the conversation, the nuclear renaissance. in face of what just happened a mere year ago at Fukushima, why are we still accepting nuclear power?
I don't think people are accepting it now after Fukushima. In fact, I saw a poll yesterday in the New York Times to say that about 60% of Americans now are cautious and wary and concerned about nuclear power. That's post-Fukushima, which shows that the nuclear industry have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in the past few years saying that they're the answer to global warming, even though they cause global warming in their own right because they're undergirded by huge industrial infrastructure, mining, milling, enriching uranium, building reactors, produce a huge amount of CO2 and global warming gases. So they advertise in Scientific American, on NPR, all over the place, which was really wicked. I rang NPR and said, why are you taking these ads from the nuclear energy industry? And they couldn't really answer me. Money. Underwriting, they call it, but it's advertising. But now the Fukushima accident, I predict, will lead to the end of nuclear power, not just in Japan, Germany, Italy, Switzerland, Belgium, which have all said no, but China, America. And also, you know, it's not if but when you have a meltdown. And I tell you, when Americans dying are dying of acute radiation illness and leukemia, that's it. So it hasn't hit you yet. Do you have to wait till it hits you before you develop some common sense and do the right thing?
Yeah, I wonder about that because, on the other hand, even though we're facing, you know, peak oil and energy challenges, we're being told that we have to have nuclear because the oil is running out.
That's rhubarb.
And that there's a whole new safer generation of nuclear facilities.
Those two statements are lies. You use oil for transportation, not to generate electricity. One, and two, the new reactors are much, much more dangerous by orders of magnitude than the present light water reactors because they're fueled with plutonium, where 1/1,000,000th of a gram is a carcinogen. They're cooled by liquid sodium, which explodes when exposed to air. So if you get a hole in a pipe, you get a meltdown. And 5 kilos or 10 pounds of plutonium is critical mass. So if you've got 100 tons of plutonium in a reactor and you lose the coolant and there's a meltdown and you get 10 pounds of plutonium together, you get critical mass and a massive nuclear explosion scattering, you know, tons and tons of plutonium to the four winds, which is the most ghastly, hideous machine I could ever imagine. They're the new safe reactors.
And let me ask you, too, about something that you'd mentioned before, just the entrenched power of money and where we are in this country in dealing with the influence of money in politics.
Yeah. You know, I said today in my speech that Congress is full of corporate prostitutes. I mean, what else can you say? They are. And even Obama's a corporate prostitute. Until you get that blasted corporate money out of politics, the politicians will do whatever the corporations want, and to hell with the people, to hell with their health and well-being, to hell with what 99% want. So therefore, we need a revolution. We need a peaceful, sagacious, quiet revolution led by knowledge and education, like the one we had in the 80s, where we educated the majority of Americans to know nuclear war was bad for their health. And in 5 years, and I helped to lead that movement with my fellow physicians, from most people supporting the concept of nuclear war, better dead than red, in 5 years, 80% opposed nuclear war. And so therefore, that was the second American Revolution.
When Radio EcoShock returns, the conclusion of Jerry Williams interviewing Dr. Helen Caldicott. Then I'll talk with Dr. Suzanne Moser about getting real on our future in a disturbed climate. Stay tuned.